If only you had been my brother, sucking with me at the teat of my mother. Then I could kiss you in public without anyone thinking twice. I would lead you, and I would bring you into the house of my mother, that you might instruct me. I would furnish you with a potion of wine perfumed with the fresh juice of pomegranates. I would furnish you with a potion. So if we look in the, this is from Song of Songs, chapter 8, verses 1 and 2 of the Ward Green translation from 2003, verse 2 there, the American Standard Version reads, I would cause thee to drink of spiced wine. I would furnish you, in the translation of yours truly, with a potion of wine perfumed with the fresh juice of pomegranate. Wow, the allergies are going to be bad until it rains. That's what happened. And so I wasn't suffering until I turned off the HEPA filter just a few minutes ago. And then I immediately felt the difference. So we'll see how the study goes. If only you had been my brother sucking it with me at the teat of my mother, then I could kiss you in public without anyone thinking twice. King Solomon wrote in Song of Songs, chapter 8, verse 1. I would lead you and I would bring you into the house of my mother that you might instruct me. I would furnish you with a potion of wine perfumed with the fresh juice of pomegranates. This is Solomon writing to his beloved Shulamite maiden. So that's talking about, no, it's not. It's not him. He wrote this book, but he's saying, if only you'd been my brother. So it's not him who's saying that. It's the Shulamite maiden saying that, if only you'd been my brother. How do we know that? Well, verse 4 says, I am fully committed along with all the daughters of Jerusalem. So that's how we know it's written from the perspective of the maiden or the daughter of Jerusalem, one of the daughters of Jerusalem. At the beginning here, that part is written from her perspective. There's some beautiful things there. Chapter 8, verse 7. Abundant waters cannot extinguish love, and rivers cannot wash it away. If a man were to donate all the riches of his house for love, they surely would be despised. That's one of the most powerful, I was going to say the most powerful scripture in all, or verse in all of scripture. It's a remarkable point. Before we watch our Thor Heyerdahl adventure, we're going to attempt here. I haven't slept since last night. I didn't go to bed. I just woke up, so I'm not talking sensibly all the time here. I'm just not. But we're going to go, and I'm going to get some. We're looking at Song of Solomon, aren't we? So we might as well click on that as well and look at it's this is the last chapter of Song of Solomon that we just read, right? But once we pop that up, it's easier to see it. There we go. See that our browser window is the right size. And chapter 3 of the Ark of Urartu, we did paragraph 5 yesterday. Very long study yesterday. Today we have a long one as well. But I want to show you something also. I made my third... Not my third. See, I told you I was groggy. Or that I just woke up. I am groggy. But I'm just hoping I can do the study now because I want to be able to go to bed any time. And not have to... I want to be able to make sure I remember to do things that I do normally before I go to bed, even though I'm not going to bed. But I don't want to forget to make the video. I made my fifth belt, not my third belt. My fifth belt. This is the fifth belt I've made. This one, I've got a buckle on it right now that says Texas to the Bone. Just a buckle I bought because I thought it was one of the finer looking buckles, and it had a message, whereas many of the belt buckles that you see, the Western buckles, they don't have any message at all on them. They don't have anything to say. So this one at least has a message. It says Texas to the Bone. Longhorn steer is on there as well. But this belt is with the orange or tobacco colored, as it's called, Sapici, which is Italian leather. Sapici leather. And I made it with staples for the first time ever. First belt I ever made as a snap belt. My first ever snap belt, which means I can take the buckle right off of it and replace it with any other buckle. Not just the Western buckles. Can be replaced with any other buckle. And so I had to make my own. So here I can show you what the snap loop looks like on the inside here, where the staples are that hold it together. It's where the belt loop, I should say, the belt loop that retains the belt. What's that called again? I forgot if there's another name for it. It's a belt loop. It is. And it's a holder. The keeper. It's called the keeper. Yeah. The keeper. That's what it is. There. Now the snap. If I get the snap shut, I can feel them engage. And then when they're engaged, these snaps are pretty good. They hold pretty solidly, which is impressive. But to do that, I had to use a Forstner bit on the back side of the leather to make a circle hole, a circular hole with a flat bottom on it, deep enough so that these snaps could be fastened securely. More snaps are supposed to be scheduled to be, I should say, delivered today, which might be long enough that I wouldn't have to make those holes in the future. But this is my first snap belt, so. And, you know, I ended up making a lot more holes in it because the first holes I made were just a bit too big for all of the Western style buckles that have the little round knob on the end. Like this one, I can barely get it out, and I only made that hole slightly smaller, by one size smaller. And yet now I can barely get the buckle out of it, whereas before it was so loose. So because I made the first set of holes 1 inch apart, I just added another set of holes in between those. Makes it also a unique style or a unique belt in the way that the holes are set too. There's no other belt in my collection that has holes that are spaced that distance apart. And there's no reason why they should be spaced any differently. I think there's some odd idea that it looks bad if you have too many holes in a belt. But I think it makes it more adjustable, for one thing. It's obviously a good thing. By the way, there's something I really love about the handmade nature of it. When I cut the end of the belt, I do it by hand. I don't make a tracing on it, on the leather. I cut it by eye, and I make a few measurements just to verify that I'm symmetrical, you know. But I do the measurements typically after I've made the first attempt by hand. If it doesn't look symmetrical, I'll make a measurement. And I'll try to fix that asymmetry. But it's now the way I like it. That belt is ready to go, and I've tested it with many different belts, buckles, many different buckles. So that is a 1.5-inch belt, and my fifth belt that I've ever made, my first ever snap belt. Pretty exciting. I think I'll be making a lot more, or there's no reason not to make a snap belt, because you can change the buckle more easily than you can when you use Chicago screws. You just unsnap it, replace the buckle, and then snap it back on. Snap it back down. So the snap belt is probably the preferred way of doing it. Unless it becomes, you know, unreliable if the snaps keep coming undone or something, I guess. Or if the snaps don't actually hold. So I'll be trying to make another snap belt, but maybe not every belt. Certainly not every belt has to be a snap belt. They can be dedicated to a certain buckle, and, you know, permanently attached to that. But that means from that piece I used, I had to cut that to that width, 1.5. I now have a 1.25-inch wide piece left over, so I can make a belt 1.25 from that, which is good. I'm scheduled to get some 1.375-inch buckles that I might want to use with that other belt when I make that. I really enjoy working on leather craft. I think I'm going to find that that's enjoyable. I've got several more belts I still want to make, because I have pants that don't have belts yet. But I think that I'm soon going to be able to leave my leather stock the way it is and work on making a belt a little less frequently, where I don't have to make them every day or two. I don't think I'll keep making belts after the next few. But Jehovah is a person. The Ark of Urartu, chapter 3, verse 6. He personifies love, and he's alive. He is alive. He's a person. Blessed be Jehovah, Shem's God, Noah declared. Shem's line was greatly favored by Jehovah as his people, as was Shinong, God's farmer, or Shelah, grandson of Shem. The Chinese word shen, it's, the accent indicates an upward movement of the pitch. The Chinese word shen means spirit, God, later known as Yandi, meaning the flame emperor. Shinong fought with Nimrod, or Qi Yu, as he's known in Chinese history. The region of Mesopotamia, or the fertile farmland between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, was through the ages much contested for its importance as a trade route in a desert. Mesopotamia is in the region known as the Fertile Crescent. According to the Book of Jubilees, chapter 8, verses 21 and 22, and chapter 9, verses 2 to 4, it was land that was given to Shem, Noah's favored blessed son. Before we read that, let's go back to this map again, showing the Fertile Crescent here in the purple color. It's this crescent-shaped piece of land that is a place irrigated by rivers that makes it fertile, a place which is possible, in through which it's possible to travel without dying of thirst. The whole land of Eden and the whole land of the Red Sea, quoting now from Jubilees, and the whole land of the East and India, and of the Red Sea and the mountains thereof, and all the land of Bashan, and all the land of Lebanon, and the islands of Kaphtor, and all the mountains of Senir and Ammana, and the mountains of Asher in the north, and all the land of Elam, Asher, and Babel, and Susan, and Meidai, and all the mountains of Ararat, and all the region beyond the sea, which is beyond the mountains of Asher towards the north, a blessed and spacious land, and all that is in it is very good. The first portion came forth for Elam and his sons to the east of the river Tigris till it approaches the east, the whole land of India. And on the Red Sea, on its coast, and the waters of Dedan, and all the mountains of Mebri and Elah, and all the land of Susan, and all that is on the side of Pharnak to the Red Sea and the river Tina. And as for Asher, came forth the second portion, all the land of Asher and Nineveh and Shinar, and to the border of India. Book of Jubilees, chapter 8, verses 21 and 22, and Jubilees 9, verses 3 and 4. If I click on it, does it come up? No, that link was broken. We have another link somewhere in the article to the Book of Jubilees, and that is something I have open. That's the Book of Jasher, actually, right there. There's the picture from our paragraph for today. Picture of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Obviously some kind of illustration that was made for a publication at some point. I'm just trying to find out whether we've got the Book of Jubilees here somewhere open. But that's okay. It's all right. We don't need it to be open. It's certainly not difficult to look up the Book of Jubilees. The oral tradition of the Miao tribes, Miao Tso, they're called, a Chinese minority group, calls Nuas, or Noah's wife, Gabuluan, saying their sons were Lo Han, Lo Shen, and Jia Hu. Similar, isn't that interesting to the name Yahweh or Jehovah? The name Jia Hu, which evidently is Japheth, and Lo Han is evidently Ham, and Lo Shen is evidently Shem. Now Lo Shen, Shem begat Elon or Elam and Negashur or Asher. The Chinese character Shen, that character represented by two different symbols in the kanji or the language of the Chinese people, the symbolic language, employs kanji characters for spear, fire, middle mark, China. China means the center, and that's this symbol on the right, the marker for China, which is a rectangle with a horizontal line through the middle of it, and a vertical line through the middle of it and beyond on both top and bottom. And also, or I should say, wait a minute, what is the mark for China? I'm trying to think. I think it might be, let's look at, I'm going to look it up. I want to verify this. So, I need to get a new tab just to make sure that I don't eliminate something. So let's go to, let's look up, the word in English, but we'll Translate to Chinese. Yeah, okay. It doesn't have the horizontal. Wait a minute. No, China is like that. China is two symbols. Right, okay, so let's just look at that one symbol. What does it mean? It means middle. Yeah, so the name China, it means middle, and then some other word that means country, the middle country, China. Fascinating, because isn't that fascinating? But I want to show you that symbol. So I'm going to bring that over. Where are we here? There we are. Symbol for China is this middle symbol for middle, which is a rectangle with a vertical line through the middle of it. Then the symbol for country, which is the other symbol. So middle country is what it means. So this, the symbol for China in the case here of the Chinese character Shan, it's a rising pitch, Shan. The second character has an additional horizontal line through that rectangle and crossing the vertical line, which is the symbol for China. It crosses over it, it's added to it, the horizontal line. And the horizontal line typically means the number one also. I'm not sure what it means in that case, but the name or the word for farm is also contained there as I write. And Shan, the descending pitch, being the pronunciation of that name or word, Shan, has this other symbol, it's depicted by this symbol, which has some similarities to the symbol for the second part of Shan there, but not entirely the same. It also has some horns on the top of it and a horizontal line below the rectangle crossing over the middle too. But that name Shan has those symbols of gold, jin, that is jin, meaning gold, J-I-N, jin, which means gold. Farm is another word that's contained there, and the meaning of the word ten is there, also in that name, Shan. So Shan was given the middle of the earth, Shinar. Now we could study these symbols at length. We're running out of time already. So Shem was given the middle of the earth, Shinar, and his Chinese name Shen. Or compare that with Shinar, with its implied middle of the earth, signifies an early form as translated to China. His Chinese name Shen. It's from the word Shinar, but also it has the similarity to, as the name Shinar does, to the name China. Sino-Tibetan languages such as Chinese are of the earliest to record a common origin with the moon god Sin of Shinar. Just like something we forgot to mention with regard to Ninus is his name, is like the name Nana, Ninus, the two N's, which is similar to what we talked about with the name Kainan having the two N's. Now Yu Chao, which is two Chinese symbols shown here, in English means there's a nest, and he's one of the three august ones in Chinese history, revered for inventing houses. Every house is built by someone and by God. Compare with Hebrews 3 and 4, which says that every house is built by someone, and the maker of all things is God. Shan also means good, meals, to abdicate, to rewrite. Shan, even pitch, which is this sort of pitchfork-like symbol without the lower shaft, is Chinese for mountain. That name, Shan, As the world population approaches 7 billion, China is the most populous state, 1.3 billion at the time of writing of this article. Compare that with India at 1.19. This is a typo. I just noticed it should say billion for India, not million. Wow, I didn't even notice that all the times I've read this. So that needs to be fixed too. I'll make a note of that, hopefully fix that when I make the next edit. And that's it. The references at Exodus 15:3, 1 John 4, 8, and 16, compare with John 3 and 16, and Psalms 42 and 2. So shall we now resume our watching of the expeditions of Thor Heyerdahl and the part 2-8 of the Ra Expedition from 1972, that movie? Let's see how it goes. Here we are at the 35-minute mark, roughly.
Don't forget to steer.
Welcome to the American side of the ocean.
Untie! He dipped to us. We must return the salute. Untie the halyard down there, somebody. Marie, she was late. Let's say, la corda.
Bob, where are you in hiding?
Hey!
We need help here all the time!
Next morning, the Calamar has been lost far behind. She has turned off her engines, but has drifted much more slowly than Ra. When she does catch up again, she stays for 2 days to study marine life that has gathered under the quietly drifting reed boat. After 2 days, the Calamar leaves them for her home port and disappears in the direction of the Caribbean. The perked-up papyrus stern acts as an extra sail, and to get a better balance to the ship, they decided to saw the stern off as well. But in slicing off a piece of their ship fore and aft, they also sever the long spiral rope binding the whole ship together. Fortunately, the wet papyrus has swollen so grossly that the rope is squeezed hard and can't be pulled out, even by force. By this time, they have entered the area east of the West Indies, where nearly all American hurricanes are born, with the hurricane season expected to begin at any time.
Also confirmed that the islands were very near and that we had entered American shipping lanes. We were lucky to escape any hurricane, for they had remained at sea level the whole of the last month. But we were not sinking any further. Then one day, Barbados Island was so near that the government boat, the Culpeper, was sent out to welcome us. The Culpeper followed along on our last leg towards Barbados. We expected to see it any moment.
Yeah, I think he's saying they expected to see land at any moment, but the audio had somehow been damaged.
No sooner had we sighted land than a number of small boats came out to welcome us. Now we were so near that houses could be seen ashore, and we sailed westward along the island towards the capital, Bridgetown.
That's it for today's portion of the viewing of this particular movie from 1972, The Raw Expedition Part 2, Thor Heyerdahl and his crew arriving in Barbados and being greeted by the UN research vessel, as we saw there in the first part of that. So we've now reached the end of our study also. And, I'm waking up, but I might want to go to bed at some point here. I definitely want to do my teeth, which is a procedure that takes about 25 minutes to do all the things I do with my teeth, to protect my teeth with my homemade toothpaste, for example, that is so apparently incredibly and magnificently effective, using xylitol, but I also use gum, the xylitol gum, during the day. Every time I eat something that, after I eat anything of any significance, I will chew some xylitol gum, 6 pieces at one time. But I won't, if it's too much, I will take it out of my mouth before I finish chewing it. If it's too much xylitol, because I can get sometimes a reaction to the xylitol, but it's perfectly great at killing the bad bacteria that cause tooth decay. That's why I use that, and it's so effective. And then when I brush with it as well in the toothpaste, which is fully edible toothpaste that I use, that I make myself, completely free of any fluoride or anything, it again is highly effective at preventing cavities. It's baking soda, xylitol, coconut oil, and peppermint oil for flavoring. It's all that's in it. That's it for today's study. It's October 3rd, 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 14:08 hours, North American Eastern Daylight Time. Thank you for listening and watching. I'm Ward Green. I love you very much. And on my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie saying bye for now. That was the Ark of Urartu, Chapter 3, Paragraph 6, our study for today. And rather than rushing this, let's make sure of that. Yeah, that's the chapter we studied, the paragraph that we studied today. So, and I am a little groggy, that's for sure, but that is not something that's never happened before in my life. In all the time that I was recording music and so on, I had many irregular hours of sleeping and waking up at different times of the day and night. But tomorrow we'll be looking at Chapter 3, Paragraph 7. How long is that? These are not always that long. That's not very long. But they can be very complex, some of these paragraphs, with a lot of different complex information. And then we might have to take more than one day for some of them. Oh, there's a picture of the Narmer palette. We're going to be coming to that. That's of great interest. It's such an historic object. That's the two sides of it depicted here. So it's a single item, but there's the front and back, or the probably called the obverse and the reverse or something, possibly, which is one way they used to refer to certain objects on the front and back. Obverse being the front, I think, and the reverse being the back, which would appear to be correct. But that's it. Bye for now.